There are many ways to travel around the world, but what is so specifically glorious about the road trip? The romance of hitting the wide open road has sparked the imaginations of writers and directors since the dawn of the highway. The journey might take longer than on a plane or in a train, but in your car, restrictions are lifted. You can take wrong turns that turn out to be right turns, meet weird and wonderful people, and get up close and personal with your surroundings. You might have a destination in mind, or maybe you just want to see where the ride takes you. Maybe an unexpected twist in the road or the story will lead you to places you'd never have otherwise explored. You're listening to The Road Ahead in association with Audi. In each episode, we'll be exploring different paths around the world across four different continents. This week, we're in South Africa. Well, I'm not. Since I've been exploring the other side of the world on this series, I'll be handing this one over to Augustin Machelari. He'll be kicking around Cape Town before heading into Hermanus, coastal wine country where connoisseurs watch whales flick their tails off the shoreline. From there, he'll continue to the Garden Route to explore 200 miles of the most beautiful driving in the world.
The Garden Route is an apt descriptor for the length of the N2 motorway that stretches from Mossel Bay in the Western Cape to Storms River in the Eastern. Inland, Finbosch-speckled mountains separate the verdant coast from the Karoo, the great desert-like zone famed for extremes of heat and cold. Not so the Garden Route, which, thanks to its unique topography and position at the meeting point of the South Atlantic and Indian Oceans, is known as one of the mildest places on Earth. Driving through this extraordinary landscape, the ocean's siren call is hard to ignore, and surfers will surely want to strap a board to the roof before setting off. But those of a more terrestrial disposition won't be disappointed. The twists and turns of the road conceal an embarrassment of cultural, gastronomic, and natural riches. So buckle up, and let's take on the road ahead. South Africa is a land of contrasts, and nowhere is this more clearly illustrated than its second city, the glorious Cape Town. Perched on the coast, it nestles in the shadow of Table Mountain, which looms ever-present across the city. Wreathed in clouds, it sends weather shooting into town, which can dissipate as quickly as it arrives. The city's unique location, the gradient of the roads, speaks to San Francisco, and, much like the Golden City, it boasts a wealth of easily accessible experiences beyond the urban. With only a day to take it in, we head to Origin Coffee for a refined single-origin boost. There, we catch up with owner and founder Joel Singer, who tells us more about what makes this city special.
You know, the Cape, for me, it's a little bit about a relaxed lifestyle. Some of that can be with friends, some of it can be going out. But, you know, it's really in the Cape, you're able to juxtapose this kind of everything you could want out of an urban experience together with everything you could want out of a natural experience. Cape Town is big Sur Napa Valley and Sonoma Valley and San Francisco all in one small place. You know, so 20 minutes from here, you're in the winelands. Another 20 minutes from here, you're on one of the most beautiful beaches you've ever seen anywhere in the world, full of beautiful people jumping in the sea, as cold as it might be. So it's that combination of be on the mountain, be on the beach, be in the sea, have a beautiful drink somewhere at sunset, go for an extraordinary meal somewhere, hang out with your friends. It's just got this laid back, but it's got everything. So that ability to do everything in one day is really what makes the Cape an enjoyable and extraordinary experience.
With a week on the Garden Route to look forward to, we opt to explore Cape Town's other great attraction, its wealth of culture. The Thomas Heatherwick-designed Zeitzmacher stands as the obvious arty landmark, but in spite of its reputation as Africa's Tate, it's far from the only game in town. We catch up with South African artist Russell Bruns to learn more about what keeps the art scene ticking.
The art school within Cape Town is called Michaelis, and that is the University of Cape Town's art school, and that's centered right in the heart of the city, and that kind of provides a breeding ground for feeding artists within to the world. But most galleries in the city, if you approach them and you ask for a few quick tips on where to go next, on their opinion on what is currently showing, they'll definitely be open. And I guess with any small art community, there is a sense of support, and most galleries are helping other galleries out, because what the art world does need is everyone to kind of for the sector to survive.
We're hitting the road soon to go and
check out the Garden Route. What are your kind of cultural hits as you drive out of the city? You know, Norval Foundation, I think, is on the way, so we'll take ourselves past that. But as you kind of drive through the country, what is there to see? Are there good places to stop?
Yeah, you guys are heading up the coast. There are two ways of approaching the coast. You're going to start on the Garden Route, which is in Mossel Bay. I would prefer to go inland up until that point. Inland offers you an insight into the Klein Karoo, which is the Karoo, which is South Africa's indigenous landscape. And within that barren kind of desert-like landscape, there are a lot of small artist communities living out there. And a lot of Cape Town-based artists or Cape Town-educated artists have relocated into those spaces to produce their work. A lot of DJs are out there. Ginger Baker from Cream lives out there, which is quite funny. I know Felix Leban lives out in the Karoo. It's definitely worth considering going inland and then pushing out into the coast.
With Russell's tips firmly taken on board, we take our leave of Cape Town. As we set off from the city, however, there's just enough time to make a stop at the Norval Foundation. It opened earlier this year, and with its focus on 20th and 21st century African art, it offers an intimate alternative to the larger Zeitzmacher. Perched in an unlikely position between a prison and the US Embassy, it nonetheless offers a spectacular interplay of art and nature with its impressive, rotating exhibitions, supplemented by a carefully designed sculpture garden. As we set off, there's just time to hear more about it from its CEO, Alana Brundin, as well as why South Africa's art scene is well worth making time for.
I believe not only is it great art coming out of this continent right now, but it's also kind of a rebalance of a time we were a little bit forgotten. And so I think there's a renewed focus on the continent and also seeing the amazing new identities coming out from here right now. The shifts, there's huge shifts. I think it's all very interesting and we can see it in the work.
In terms of the space itself, you know, you've got a library inside, you've got a restaurant, you've got a shop outside in the gardens, there's a children's play area, there's an amphitheater for performance. How important and why is it so important to kind of create this environment that people want to come into and stay in?
Well, that is very important. I suppose, you know, we always want to, again, we're addressing the balance. You always have to almost balance a museum and attraction, which in the art world is very, you know, it's as much as you want to fight it, you have to offer it. You have to make it kind of 51% fun, 49%, you know, educational, because I do feel otherwise you lose the audience. There's so much that you compete against. We work with an incredible group of curators and constantly have to say to them, also break it down to that we have different layers of bringing in a new audience and let's try and keep them, because I also believe that it's one step getting them here, but to keep them here and to keep them coming back, that's actually the biggest challenge we have. We know this is really the cathedrals of our time. This is the places where people come together, the community centers. People ask also why Steenberg, because it's a little bit out of the city center. And I always say, why not? It's such a beautiful place and it's a beautiful community around us. It can't be all in one area. So no, I think it's a very special time, and places like this and MoCA, it is actually, it just shows that the continent is ready for more. The giant is actually stepping up in more ways. And I think the world needs Africa. And so I believe this is the signs of hope on this continent.
Gearing up for the first leg of our drive, there are no arguments over music. Before we set off, we checked in with one of South Africa's most exciting bands, Good Luck, and producer Ben Peters gave us a recommendation that's to become the soundtrack of our trip.
It's actually a cover that we did of a song called I've Been Thinking About You. I think it's just like, it's really well suited to just cruising down the road, and especially on the route to the Garden Route, it's so scenic. The landscape around you changes so much. You go through a couple of different mountain passes. You go through some exquisite farmland that just stretches for as far as the eye can see. And then the next thing you know, you've got the ocean. Like, and it just suddenly, like, you're driving along and the next thing, it's just there. So you arrive in Mossel Bay, which is this lovely little quaint Afrikaans town. If you haven't come to South Africa, or if you have come here and you haven't driven the Garden Route, you've missed out on an opportunity that I think is probably every Cape Townian's, like, sort of love affair, is to leave the city and to do the Garden Route drive. I've been thinking about you.
With the windows down and the music pumping, we head for the hills and the mountain pass that'll take us away from the metropolis and on to the Garden Route. Baboons, unfazed by the traffic, stare insolently at cars speeding by as we drive on. While Stellenbosch might be the most famous winemaking region in South Africa, it's far from the only one. We're making for Hemelen Ada, an almost mystical valley wreathed in mist that stretches inland from the coast. It's the centre of operations of Franco Lurens, a young and ferociously committed winemaker who's kind enough to welcome us in and talk us through the elegant simplicity of his production. You've got a mad variety of different, as you say, your hands off with the wine, but you've got these crazy, so we've got barrels, a concrete egg, concrete cubes, and these are all different wines.
I think, yeah, the most important part of it is the fact that these are all neutral vessels. So, like I said, we don't want to interfere with any of the wine making side of things. So at the back, yeah, we got concrete cubes, and that's got Cinzo in them. So, yeah, the whole idea about these cubes are they don't let any air through, really. And Cinzo is a variety that we feel gets a bit tired in barrel, because barrel lets a lot more air through than the concrete, you know, and that's also a very big element of these different vessels that we store our wines in.
Great, so we're just going through into yet another room. I mean, I don't want to guess how many barrels there are per room. You could tell me, I'm sure.
I think I'm almost 40 barrels in here, probably about 38 or something. And then, you'll see the amphora pots on the side here as well.
Right, these are like, I mean, the barrels, everyone knows what a barrel looks like, right? But these are really something like out of, you know, classical history. They're amazing and different sizes as well. So what's the kind of thinking behind the variation in scale?
These are actually made locally. I think the guy's called Yogi. I think he's the only guy with a big enough oven to bake these. Because you'll see they're not the same size. And I don't think he knows exactly how many liters they take. I don't think we actually know ourselves. We have a rough estimation of how many go in there. But it's more about the shape and the fact that these are warmer than, this is glass stoneware, basically. It's warmer than made like terracotta. It looks like terracotta, but it's a lot more warmer. So there's basically almost like glass, to be honest. And the main reason for these were the fact that we made a wine from these two old vineyards that's on top of hills in Stellenbosch and Botlhaerei. The clay that they used to make these pots were pretty close to where the vineyards were. So the idea was to put something into a pot that's actually made from the soil where the vineyards were growing.
So what we're giving it a sniff, not the technical term.
Yeah, so basically it's giving a bit of a swirl and then a bit of a smell and yeah, just have a drink. It's a 2017 white blend. You know, I've got a big passion for lesser known varieties in South Africa or small plantings of varieties that's available, and they're playing around with these and making wines from them. So you'll see it's driven by Vedelo, which is a Portuguese variety which I found in Stellenbosch. And then the second portion is Swartland Chenin. And then Grenache Blanc is also from Stellenbosch. And the Grenache Blanc also ferments on the skins for a little while, for about 7 days. Just give it a bit of body and characteristics, you know, like a bit of oomph, if you want to call it that. And then the Roussan is from also from Stellenbosch. And then the Claret Blanche is also Stellenbosch. And then the Claret is the one that was in amphora pots for about 10 months. Yeah, so that was in clay pots. The rest were all in old barrels. Yeah. It's called Lenny Karine. It's named after my wife. Because back in 2015, I wanted to get engaged and didn't have any money. So I made 2 barrels of wine for her and then, sold it to buy a ring. So that's the story behind the label. The name just stuck, and that's actually her on the label there as well. So that's just the story behind the name and the label.
A road trip must always be conducted by a duo, if only to guarantee there's a designated driver. Out of fairness, it's really only a sip of Franco's marvellous medicine before we set off. Kindly, he lets us keep the bottle to enjoy from the comfort of a safely static hotel later on. Right, so we're currently in Hermanus. It's Tuesday morning. We drove here from Cape Town yesterday, making a side stop in a valley called Hemelen Ada. The weather up there was overcast. We were inside a cloud. There was sort of rain coming in fits and starts. It was really dramatic. It kind of reminded me of the moors in Scotland or in the Peak District. Very different landscape to the one that we've now got used to down by the coast, where the weather is clear, the sun's beating down. Right now we're standing so close to the sea that if we were ever any further out, we'd be wet. And from where we're standing, we can see whales just jumping out of the ocean. The town itself is really beautiful. It's kind of got this amazing mix of colonial era housing. There's some newer stuff, but even in the newer stuff, you know, there are great restaurants. Last night we went out for seafood and I had the most delicious prawn that I've ever put in my mouth. There's a kind of really nice sort of modernist look to a lot of these houses, great big wooden windows that wouldn't look out of place in Northern Europe, to be honest. And then thatch, which I did not expect to see in South Africa, but they have a rich tradition of thatching. Some of the most beautiful houses have this kind of amazing fusion of South African and colonial influenced architecture. And it just works absolutely well in a way that fusion, you know, sometimes doesn't. Back to the sea, the expanse of it blows the mind. It just goes on and on and on out into nothing. I mean, I think next stop from here is Antarctica. So that kind of says it all, really. And these whales, which periodically emerge to just spout huge gouts of water into the air, their tails are coming up so fast that you almost stop noticing them. Hermanus is our last stop before we hit the garden route proper. From here, it's a 3-hour cruise to Mossel Bay and then the 190 miles of vista that comprise the drive we've come to South Africa to make. We arrive on the garden route to spend a night in the preposterously pretty Knysna, a town whose picturesque waterfront is built around a lagoon. We see a steamboat paddle out as we drive through the white, wooden, mid-century seaside buildings that make up its centre. We're here to try Île de Pain, a bakery with a reputation that stretches from cape to cape. It was co-founded by one Marcus Farbinger, a master baker from Vienna, who's been credited with the introduction of fine bakery to South Africa. We eat avocados on toast with goat's cheese. The quality of the avocado comes as no surprise. They've been consistently delicious, but the cheese is a revelation. It's made by the private and charming cheesemaker Ali van Diemter. We're directed to his farm, a half hour down a dirt track stuck behind a lorry full to the brim with manure. It mercifully turns off as we continue on straight to Ali's house. 5 Rhodesian ridgebacks welcome us before Ali himself slopes out and invites us to join him in a cheese board.
So we're being subsumed by hounds. So,
was this similar to maybe a Gouda? Not a Gouda, a Gruyere.
Oh, thank you.
I know what you mean.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The quality of the food is matched only by the quality of the hospitality as Ali introduces us to his livestock and offers a look at the tower in which he makes his produce. It's a serendipitous and moving encounter, a turn down a road that looks wrong but turns out to be right. But soon enough, we're back on the tarmac once more, driving beside a sea that stretches to Antarctica. We're not done with Knysna yet, however. We have one more essential stop to make. The garden route is a nature lover's paradise. Beyond the abundant flora, fauna of all sorts makes itself known. The sheer quantity and diversity of bird life is enough to inspire the twitcher in everyone, while as we drive we spy elephants grazing off the road. Anyone who wants to get up close and personal with a pachyderm would be advised to stay away from strangers and instead make a beeline for Knysna Elephant Park. Okay, so we're in Knysna Elephant Park and we're just trying to, we've just fed the elephants, which was absolutely amazing. Their trunks are much firmer than you might expect. It kind of feels like a hand grabbing food off your hand, except it's slimy because obviously the food is getting put straight in the elephant's mouth. So now we're standing next to what I think is maybe, if not the biggest, certainly one of the biggest elephants in the park. Happy as Larry, just stuffing its face with grass. And we're waiting to meet it properly. We're with Mac, who's one of the most experienced guards in the park, and he's going to tell us a little bit more about this particular elephant.
So here we are standing in front of Sally, which is the biggest one, the oldest one in the group. She's 29 years old, and of course one of the first two elephants which opened the park in 1994.
So she's really used to being around people. We wanted to talk to the most patient elephant.
This is the one we can talk to. She, you can imagine she's been around people for like 24 years, every single day, so she's very much used, very calm. Whenever we see her walking away, it's not that she's walking away from us, she just want to stop where there's food.
Okay, so we're walking right up. Sally is looming over me. Her skin feels absolutely extraordinary. I think I'm at about the same height as maybe just the bottom of her shoulder. So how much do elephants, she's grazing away, how much grass will they typically eat in a day?
Actually, it's everything together, so we're talking about grass and shrubs and trees. That would be about 6 to 8% of its body weight. That's how much they consume in a day. And roughage is about 4 tons, so that would be a minimum of 200 kilos of food a day.
Wow.
In a day, yeah.
That's like you, Kieran.
Beyond the beauty of the landscape, the hospitality of people we encounter, and the gastronomic excellence, the Garden Route offers craft and tradition of the highest quality. As we approach the end of the route, we drive past Mungo's remarkable textile mill to pick up fabrics that wouldn't be out of place in an expensive corner of London. Jonica Kabula, who works at the mill, takes us round for a look.
Mungo started in 1998. The master weaver, who is actually the founder of the company, was gifted 2 looms. And he wove his fabrics, which he sold down at his wife's shop at the time. And that is where Mungo Retail is now. And then the cotton is actually South African. So it's grown here, it's spun here, and it is produced here. And we get it in bales of already spun cotton. And that's when we will start weaving. Now here, we've got the old looms. That is a Rooty loom over there. These are all from the 1800s. You've got the Rooty loom from Switzerland and the Lancashire loom. This one is from the UK. And that, in order for it to weave that complicated pattern that you see there, it's got a Hattersley dobby that has been attached to it. That's that little metal thing at the top.
Not only is Mungo's mill open to the public, the shop is nearby, offering the perfect chance to secure a souvenir before hitting the road once again. We cross Blue Crown's Bridge, where thrill seekers hurl themselves into the abyss on the world's highest bridge bungee jump, distracting ourselves from our feelings of inadequacy with memories of Sally. Our last stop before we reach Port Elizabeth, which is officially beyond the end of the garden route but our final destination on this trip, is one of the few lodges that welcome visitors in the breathtaking Sitsikama National Park. The food has consistently impressed us, but tonight we decide to cook for ourselves as we consider the stars.
We've got our barbecue to the left of the front door, and above us, the most extraordinary sky filled with stars. No points for pointing out the Orion's Belt. We all know that one. Find the North Star and the Big Dipper for 20, and if you can show me the Great Bear, then you win the game. On our left, we've got this barbecue going. It's called a braai here, and a very helpful man came and lit it for us, which was nice because it saved us both having to kind of prove ourselves, prove our masculinity in the classic barbecue lighting competition that men have together. We've got some boerwurst on there. We've got some lamb chops, and we've got some kebabs. I'm not sure what they are, sort of miscellaneous. I'm sure it'll all be absolutely delicious. And we're waiting for that to cook. Apart from the guests who are staying here and the staff who work here, this place is also home to a number of peacocks, a couple of peahens, if we're being technical, an army of monkeys in the trees. In fact, they're so aggy, those monkeys, that we have to keep our windows shut and our doors firmly. And a resident crocodile who lives, worryingly, just behind my lodge. He seems pretty docile. Apparently, he only gets fed once every 3 weeks, and then he eats meat, of course.
The final leg of our journey takes place in driving rain. As we leave Sitsikama and the garden route behind us, the colours that had overwhelmed the senses are muted under an onslaught of water. Sad, perhaps, but necessary to ensure that the verdancy we so enjoyed is there for those driving the garden route behind us. It's with an appropriate sense of melancholy that we arrive in Port Elizabeth. It's an unprepossessing town with something of a reputation among the more cosmopolitan Capetonians, but it's a reputation we're quick to discover is ill-deserved as we meet local architect Neil Basson for an insider's guide to the goings-on in PE.
PE is, it's a small city, and what you get is a lot of, you still get like family-owned restaurants, like good family-owned restaurants that's been around for ages, like, I mean, before I was even born. You get guys that's been going to the same place for the same meal for the past 40 years or whatever. But what it's also created is a place where you kind of have to do good food or good drink. Otherwise, you won't survive, you know. And yeah, so it has to be quality.
All right, you've got a rare day off. Neil works hard as an architect. How would you spend it? Where would you go for drinks, for food, lunch and dinner?
Like most days, I do start my morning off at Remo's, the Italian restaurant, like right next to my office. They definitely have the best coffee in town. Then lunchtime, I would definitely go to Fernando's Chicken House up in Richmond Hill. It's a local Portuguese lunch spot, selling the best chicken and ribs you'll ever taste in your life. Probably, yeah, go to the Beer Yard in Richmond Hill. They've got a bunch of craft beers on tap. Go have a beer outside next to the pool. And then, and I would definitely end the night off at Natty's Thai restaurant up in St. George's Park. It's like kind of inviting a bunch of friends over to your house to have dinner, but there's this amazing chilled vibe, lots of red wine. Yeah, you never know when it's going to end, so you might walk out there at 12 or 1 or 3, you don't know. Yeah. The perception from the bigger cities is like I said before, like my brother-in-law used to call it the armpit of South Africa, but he doesn't really know what's going down here, you know. So it's really not called the friendly city for nothing.
Settling into the social delights of Port Elizabeth, we reflect on the beauty of the drive. Almost 500 miles from Cape Town, the road has spoiled us with the bounties hidden around every bend. Beautiful creatures, warm hospitality and delicious food, all cupped in the hand of a landscape that takes the breath away round every turn. It's almost impossible to fight the urge to turn the car around and do it all again.